William, it's so nice to be here in conversation with you. I've known William since I was 20 years old, and I had moved to Cairo for 1 year after university. And like many people, I was passing through downtown and stumbled upon the townhouse and found that it was one of the most magical places I'd ever been to. I'm sad to say that Mina isn't here, but Mina was the first person I met. Mina, some of you know Mina. He was, I think, your first employee.
Yes.
He ran the bookshop. He has many skills, but chief among them is charm. So
he should be here.
I was naturally drawn to Mina, and then I met May Abdul Dahab, who was your former student of yours and your first curator. And unbeknownst to you, May was going to leave the gallery to go to Amsterdam to pursue a curatorial studies course, and she asked me to fill in for a couple of weeks, and my responsibilities would involve doing your email, because email was still a non-problem. So I was ventriloquizing William for 2 or 3 weeks,
yes.
And then 2 or 3 weeks became almost 3 years, so I can say without a doubt that it was one of the most fortuitous accidents of my life. And the best kind of education. And I think those of you who've worked at the gallery have probably had similar. And so I have just a little bit of background. I know most of you are intimate with the gallery, but I just, for those of you who might not know much about the townhouse, and you could just not listen at this point, but the lane in which townhouse sits, and again, those of you who've been there know this, is very special and critical to the understanding of how the gallery works. You might call it Shakespearean, which is to say Kyrene. The gallery is surrounded by car mechanics, glass and wood workshops, a girls' school, a crumbling Baroque palace, a kidney hospital. Just around the corner is one of the most popular restaurants in Cairo called Abu Tariq Koshery, which is known to taxi drivers all around the city. And so it's a very particular place. And in the basement of the gallery itself, the main building, there's also a prayer space, so sometimes you're going upstairs and you might look down and see some men engaged in prayer. The lane is also a place of overlapping social and political histories, that's to say colonial, Khedival from the time of the Khedive, revolutionary, pre- and post-revolution, that's two revolutions, the 1952 revolution, the Nasserist revolution, and the 2011 revolution, which dramatically unseated Mubarak, and of course the counter-revolution that followed. And all of these histories, I think, have seeped into the texture of the lane, but also the soul of the gallery and its ethos and texture. So you can't speak about one without the other. The neighborhood also has a unique cast of, I would say, heroes and villains. There are daily scandals, there are dramas, there are love stories, betrayals. For a long time, when I first started working with you, there was even a currency called the Nebrawi mark, with which you'd buy your coffee and tea. So it just gives you a sense of, you know, it lends itself to mythologizing this neighborhood. So at the center of this compelling and endlessly interesting picture is William Wells, to my left. William founded the gallery in 1988 after having spent many... 1998, after having spent several years in the region, working as an educator. William is very good at being vague. So William is the visionary, he's the mediator, he's the godfather, he's the village therapist, he's the wedding planner, and so much more. So he wears an unusual number of hats. So among the gallery's many distinctions, just very briefly, Townhouse has launched at least one generation, or at least two generations of artists. A first generation might include people like Doa Ali, Wael Shawi, Sharif Al-Azma, Hassan Khan, Iman Issa, Maha Ma'moon, Ayman Ramadan. It's also negotiated a delicate schism between the state and the independent art sector, and I think that William has raised that negotiation to the level of an art. The gallery has also provided a model, I think, for how to be in one's community and beyond. And above all, Townhouse has served as a gathering ground in a country in which there has and continues to be a premium placed on gathering. So artists, theater actors, bloggers, filmmakers, refugees, street children, and others have long considered Townhouse home. And I think more and more, actually, writers and poets, etc. So it's taken on a sort of literary sensibility as well. So the gallery has more distinct constituencies than any art space I can think of anywhere around the world. When I first started working there, it also offered the neighborhood toilet and phone line. So how great if you might see some art along the way as you're going to use the toilet. Finally, and we'll come back to this, the gallery, as it's referred to, has also spawned or cultivated and incubated other organizations that have come to be. So the Contemporary Image Collective, which we might talk about a little bit, Beirut, not the city, but the organization, Madrar, and many more. And there are also plenty of individuals who have worked with William and have gone on to do extraordinary things. Some of them are in this room. Laura Cardera, Fiona Fox, Anya Shremke, I always get that wrong, Claire Davies, who's now at the Metropolitan Museum, Sara Rifke, and many more. Lina Atala, who now runs Madame Oster. So I'm definitely leaving some people out. But it also seems to indicate that a steady stream of extraordinary women have worked with William. And there have been some men, too. But
very few.
So I thought William is extraordinarily good at storytelling. And I thought, for those of you, and I'm always interested in the backstory of the gallery, and I'm wondering if we can go back to 1998, and if you can evoke a little bit the artistic and political backdrop in which you arrived in this lane, and what you recognized was a need, or if you can characterize it as such, and what motivated you, in fact, to start the gallery, and perhaps you can talk a little bit also about those initial responses.
Okay, well, actually, Nagar's covered everything. I mean, we could almost take the break right now. But I will go back to 1998, because, in fact, I did move to Cairo in 1985 with the intention of setting up a gallery very much like what Townhouse has evolved into. I was extremely interested in artists that were looking at and reflecting the city as it was, as I was experiencing it, and not necessarily what was controlled by the ministry. Representation is a very, very important part of the government's, if you like, his sense of ownership. So, but there were so many young artists that were actually producing work that didn't fit into that. But when I first moved there, it was almost impossible. First, it was almost impossible to find them. And so, but literally, it did take me decades of working with development, seeing how development actually worked within the country, as a freelancer, and then working with education, as I mentioned. But then in 1998, suddenly one became aware of the fact that something had changed. You could feel it in the air. Some independent galleries had started. Karim Francis had opened just a few years before, as a commercial space. Mashrabeya Gallery around the corner had opened up back in the 80s. And then also there was Cairo Berlin had recently opened up in the late 90s. And they were all within walking distance of each other. And this was absolutely interesting to me because they were not just commercial galleries in the sense of putting up paintings and people coming into their cars and buying the paintings and going off. They were suddenly doing experimental installation pieces. They were inviting artists to do work that wasn't commercial. Maybe only one in a year. But the very fact that they were taking this step, and there was an audience for it, I began to, through the government Salon de Shabab with the youth salon, which is held annually, to through that to discover that there were young artists that were producing work that really excited me, even though one young artist, I remember Sabah Naim, who now she's a major artist, and not just in Egypt, but abroad. But I remember walking to the bathroom and seeing her work hung upside down. And literally, when one sort of began to look at it properly, you realized that this was an incredible young woman. And she was in her early 20s. And how that was one of those moments, and I've never forgotten it, that it just excited me so much. And I thought, if I don't open up this space at this moment in time, somebody else will. And I wanted to be the person to do it because that's what I had, intended all these years ago. But when I started looking for spaces, everybody was directing me to the avenues, the mainline streets, the shop fronts. Nobody would let me walk down these back lanes. It was like the Samsars, or I forget what street actually
referred to. Real estate.
Real estate people that are, you know, on the streets all the time. They were always just saying no. And then one day I was walking without them, and I went down this street, and I was just so amazed by these buildings. I thought that the girls' school was abandoned. I thought the boys' school, which is the palace, it was a working boys' school at the time, I thought that was abandoned. I mean, every building I looked at looked as if it was falling apart and abandoned. And I started asking the mechanics in the street, and they started telling me, no, are you kidding? This is a girls' school, it's a working school, there's like, you know, 2,000 girls in there, there's like 800 boys in that space. But these buildings are all abandoned. And the neighborhood, which if you've seen the maquette outside, it does give you the flavor of the architecture of the space. But what is missing in the maquette, which is so vital to me, and that is the people and the constituents that you talked about. And that was really what charged me. Suddenly, you know, immediately when I said I was looking for a gallery, and this young mechanic said, well, you know, we can go upstairs and we can look at in this building if you like. He said, it's locked up, but we can just break down the door. That kind of attitude, I thought, yeah, I'm into that. So we went in, he broke down the door, we saw this space that had been closed for 50 years, so one can just imagine the state of it. And I just loved it. I loved the whole, you know, the sheer size of the rooms.
Can you talk a little bit about the history of that particular building? Or what you knew then and what you've come to?
Well, at the time, I actually didn't know anything about this building. I knew it was owned by a woman who lived in Medinat Nasser on the other side of the city, and that the flats, there were people living in the building, there were people living on the roof, there were workshops, some legal, some not legal. The coffee shops were part of the land of the building, all working illegally. Most of the people working out in front were informal workers.
Lingerie production,
yeah, women's bras particularly. On the second floor, these men, that was very strange. And they stayed there right up until 2011, actually, making bras. But it was just the excitement of that room. And then, of course, I started to go around and talking to artists whose work that I wanted to show. And when I told them that I was really excited about the space that I'd found down this back alley, they all were so keen that I opened a space, but not there. Not in that lane, not in that building. And they were absolutely adamant that that was not the place where a contemporary art space should be. And I think I might be repeating myself, but there were no streetlights. The road itself wasn't paved. It was a very dark, masculine, almost, one would say, threatening kind of atmosphere, particularly in the evening with the darkness under the trees and so on. So they just said, no, keep looking. But in my excitement for the building, I thought, okay, well, I'm going to take it. And if it doesn't work, then I've got a beautiful apartment for myself. And then I started asking the people in the street, would they be prepared, with my partner, Yasser Jrab, would they be prepared to actually restore this first floor of the building? And they all got very excited about it. They saw it as a project of like a shop. And they thought, yeah, it'd be great to have a shop here. So they spent 3 months, you know, sleeping in the building and fixing it for us, the floors, the ceilings, the walls, putting electricity and so forth. And in that 3 months, while I was still trying to convince the artists unsuccessfully, we also got to know the constituents you were talking about. And that was really important. Not just the people who work in the lane, but there were so many street children that actually congregated within those back streets. And those street children saw that as a safe area for them because they were constantly being abused out in the major shopping areas in the process of begging and so forth. And it was also a safe area for refugees, primarily from Sudan, Eritrea, Somalia, because their major NGO offices were in the downtown area, just off the lane. And again, they found the coffee shops and these back streets a safe place where they were not abused. They were not, you know, confronted with racist remarks all the time. So I spent that 3 months being rejected by artists and being totally engaged with the different constituents, these marginalized groups, and the people that are working in the lane themselves, the way that they embraced this project. So we found two foreign artists, Martin McAnally and Kurt Olsen, who agreed to open our first show. And our second show was, in fact, going to be about the street children, because the street children were prime. We decided right at the very beginning, because of those 3 months, that the gallery would always have a parallel path, that it would be dedicated specifically to the promotion of the visual arts, and our second path was to the development and the education and the support of the different constituents in that street. And we have done that constantly for the last 20 years. It has never stopped. We built programs for them and so forth. So, in fact, the first exhibition broke the ice for everyone. Everybody came out of curiosity. Everybody, and I'm talking about even ambassadors, showed up, you know, cold wintry night to find out what was going to be shown in this space. And the artists themselves were, once they got into the building, they found the magic that I found. And they also suddenly realized that this was a place where conversations could take place, criticism could take place, discussions could take place, and that the gallery and the streets themselves were so fluid that the coffee shops eventually moved into the gallery to serve coffee. And those conversations led within the first year for us taking the entire building, the three floors of the building. And because the artists wanted more spaces, more experimental areas, more room to have discussions. They wanted studios. By the second year, we'd actually moved across the lane and taken another abandoned space, the first annex. By 2006, we'd taken the 650 square meter factory next to the annex. And then in 2008, the factory next to that as the performance and symposium space. And then another three-story building. And it was just a constant expansion and demand. And my intention was the visual arts. But literally from that first month, I think, I had, you know, theater people, filmmakers, musicians. Everybody was demanding the same space, of a free space. Everyone wanted a place to rehearse, to practice, to present, to perform. And the gallery was turning itself upside down every week. I mean, it's really important to understand how we were able to work with this street, because we would, in fact, close on a Wednesday night, the exhibition, and we would take everything down, deinstall through the night, and then turn it into a theater stage. And they would have performances on the Thursday night, performances on the Friday night. Everything would be taken down, and then we would reinstall for Saturday morning. And this was a constant practice in all of the spaces. And then the garages next door, when our audiences, we realized that we just couldn't even accommodate the number of people that were coming to these different activities, that we realized the garages were larger than our 600 square meter factory, that they would move their cars out of their spaces and we would move into the garage spaces for electrical music performer Hassan Khan. It is one of his major pieces in the garage across the way. And the refugees held their largest fashion shows. I mean, if you've seen the Hal Badil video, that actually was 2013, but long before 2013, that lane would sometimes accommodate up to 800 people, filling the lane to see the different performances. So, because all of the spaces were operating simultaneously. So this action, this activity was, it was brilliant. I mean, it was certainly, for me, having the support of the number of people that Nagar mentioned, who came to me and said, I want to do this program. Everybody that actually walked into my office had something they wanted to do. And even though the salary was nothing, I mean, people like Nagar came and said, I want to do Photo Cairo. So bang, all of a sudden we were doing Photo Cairo. Somebody wanted to do a symposium. I mean, it was just a constant, if you want to do it, let's do it.
So in the midst of this uninterrupted narrative of good news, there was some resistance. And I wonder, and relatedly, you know, I think part of what makes your work so compelling to me is the daily negotiation of bureaucracies, of local and international politics, of other gallerists and their feelings, artists and their feelings. And I think that's part of what Perversely you love, actually, is that kind of problem solving. But can you just talk about those first couple of years and some of the either resistance or the primary obstacles you faced in doing this kind of work?
Yeah. Because the other narrative is so much more interesting. Actually, it's probably not. But, you know, I did say we opened in December 1998. And we did open, as I just described, and it was really quite wonderful. In February of 1999, I was making a studio visit, and I went and visited a ceramic artist who lived on the 15th floor of a high-rise building. And I was not interested in the work as soon as I got up to the 15th floor and I saw this really bad art. But I was so fascinated by a ceramic artist on the 15th floor of a high-rise building. There was the kilns, there was all the clay. And so I started asking questions about him and his neighbors and how they responded to his work and so forth. And then he said, yeah, but what about the work? And I said, well, we'll come back and talk about that maybe next year. I did not know that this was a government artist. I did not know that this artist was a favorite of the minister at the time. And he went back and told everyone that I was asking these very personal questions about space rather than talk about his work. And literally in February, they held a press conference where they denounced the gallery. And they claimed that, you know, obviously I was a foreigner, so there I was receiving money from a neighbor next door that, you know, was clearly an enemy of Egypt, and that the work that I was interested in was to literally to produce work that showed the bad side of Egypt, that that was putting a bad representation of the country, and the very fact that I was foreign, I was actually trying to take this work abroad. And I mean, these accusations came so heavy, so fast. I mean, we're talking about February, you know, we'd only been open. And I remember walking down the street that evening in February, and suddenly all of these reporters from the Arab papers were just like, okay, so what? Tell us all about it. What is your agenda here? And suddenly they started to write these incredible stories about us. And, you know, even people that came to me and they would say things like, you know, we want your side. We want to know the truth. We want to put forward your story, not necessarily the negativity. So I would trust them. And they said, can we take your picture? And I say, yes. So I would sit at my desk, and they'd take my picture, and the next thing I'd know, a magazine would come out, and there I would be sitting behind this desk, and it would be like, he's controlling everything from this side. So then the art colleges were actually told, you must never attend this gallery space, you must not visit the shows. So students were forbidden right from the day one. And that was a challenge, because obviously you want to reach out to art students. And there are so many arts colleges, and I think there's probably more art colleges and art palaces and cultural institutions in Egypt dealing with the arts, visual arts, than any country in the world. I mean, you have no idea. Every little village has a cultural palace. So to have these people being told, you can't come down that back street and you must not see this work. And then, of course, stories that we were paying the Egyptian artists to produce this work, these bad images. And then, of course, even when the artists were in the room, I'd have reporters coming in and saying, why aren't you ever showing Egyptian art? And the artists would say, well, I am Egyptian and this is my work. And they went, no, but you don't think like an Egyptian, you don't talk like an Egyptian, and your work certainly isn't Egyptian. And they were going, no, I am, and this is, and we are. So these conversations were happening all of the time. And then, of course, working with the street, one has to remember that you're also dealing with security issues. And, of course, the security is watching you very closely, particularly when you've been charged with doing what you're doing. And it becomes political. And so your visitors are often political people that are looking for things that you're dealing with. So you have to develop a language. And maybe in a way, I think that in those early years and my first experiences with security, my first experiences with the abuse from the art colleges and the professors and from the ministry itself, I learned so much. Because what it did is it made me realize that I was living in a really comfortable bubble in many respects. And the art world is that. And even my street and the community that I was talking about, those constituents, that was also a bubble. Because the artists were coming in and they were actually like, wow, this street is filled with artisans. These people can make my work. And this street is filled with people that I want to talk about. I want to create work that actually translates their stories that I see, but I don't know them, often because of class differences. And the street offered those kind of conversations. So the access was actually happening all of the time. And it wasn't contrived. You know, it wasn't something I personally set out to do. It was the space did it. And the people working for me with the programs that they developed. So I was really constantly thinking and constantly dealing with legal matters, talking to security people, attempting to talk to the art colleges unsuccessfully. And I will actually just tell one little anecdote, which I think is really important, because breaking into the art colleges, you have no idea. These are amazing institutions. I mean, they have security outside, and they can tell you, townhouse, immediately, you know. So I had six students.
The state art colleges.
Yeah, state art colleges. And so I had six students, actually it wasn't six, it was about four, who came in to see me, and they said, listen, we've got studios, and they're outside on the 6th of October, they're quite far away, and, you know, we'd really like you to come and look at our work, but... you know, if it's possible, don't tell anybody. Come on a Saturday. Just drive straight out. We'll meet you. That's good. I was just about to say, like, oh, now I'm being... This is so familiar. Glitch. Stop this story immediately. All right, so, you know, I actually... the person working with me at the time was Lucy Till, who had been a curator at the Hayward, and she'd come to work with me. Literally, she came as a visitor, and then the next thing you know, she said, okay, I'm going to quit the Hayward and come and work with you for a year, and I was so lucky. Mm-hmm. And so Lucy and I, Saturday morning, we drove out to this sort of complex, and the students were there, and we went in, and they shut the door, and then they locked the door, and they said, all right, we want to know the truth. And we want you to tell us everything. What is your agenda? And there was more students there. And they said, you know, you can't deny this. We know you get money from Israel. We know that you're actually doing this. And they just threw every accusation that the media had been sort of throwing at us in our faces. And then I just thought, well, why did you invite us here? We could have had this confrontation anywhere. In the space, in the street. And they said, well, we want to know the truth. And that was it. I mean, they wanted to know the truth. And Lucy was so much better at telling the truth than I am. So she actually told the truth. And then we actually said, okay, we need you. And they believed it. But we need you to be able to access these institutions. So with the help of these students, we created something called the Students' Council, where they went round and we had students from every institution, every government college and private college, and we brought them into the gallery, and they were 90% did not like me. I don't think a lot of them do today, even still. But I gave them the gallery, gave them the keys to the gallery, the rights to invite anybody they wanted into the space. They could use that space for 1 year around our exhibitions and take control and therefore combat anything that they felt was, you know, what we were doing. The Students' Council carried on and was one of the most successful because it year after year more students came in. And the most incredible thing is that these... Now, some of them are very well-known artists, that they actually then went on to share studios, and they said to me they would never have met each other, ever, even though they were both you know, all artists. But because of the different institutions, because of the different class, you know, barriers, and they also found out by going around and trying to visit each institution to see the different ways that the universities were teaching. So, for example, the American University was very conceptual. The Zamalek College was, you know, very physical, hands-on, copy my professor's work. And as they were going around, word got out that there was a student council from Townhouse. And they were thrown out of government universities as a result. And that also was important, not for me, but for them. Because that, in charge, you know, they really became much more aggressive in bringing students in. And then you have people like Bassem Megdi, who was a student at the art college, who came to me and he said, listen, I'm a student, I'm doing this work, but the work that I'm really interested in, I'm actually doing it in Assut, which is like, you know, a couple of hundred miles away in the south, but would you come and see my studio and see this work that I'm doing? So I got on a train, went down there, saw these paintings that were so personal, so aggressive, and so full of frustration and anger at his education. And I offered him a show immediately. And he said, no, my God. He says, I have to graduate first. They will never give me a certificate if I show in Townhouse. So he graduated in June, got a certificate in July, and we had a show in September.
And Would you say adding to that tension was the fact that that was a moment when the so-called international art world was more interested, post-9/11 moment, and there was certainly a bunch of interest in the region, as it were. And I think, so you started receiving a lot of international curators that were buying meals open in every city. And Townhouse was the sort of natural go-to point. And I think that also created a lot of resentment, tension, et cetera. And I wonder how you handled that.
Well, in fact, it wasn't 9/11. It started in May of 1999. And I don't know how people started to hear about Townhouse so early on, because there was only bad press. But I was getting all of these calls from people abroad, and they were saying, listen, you know, the government is sending in their artists to this particular biennale. We've heard that there are possibly other artists working in Egypt, and we wondered if we could come and see you confidentially and privately. And they did, and that was in May. And I took them around studios. They were just amazed by the work, what they were seeing. So they went to the Ministry of Culture and they actually said, you know, listen, we found these artists that we would like to represent Egypt. And they said, no, you're having these artists. And they said, okay, you send these artists and we'll pay for these artists. So Egypt actually had two pavilions that year. One was from the independent sector, all young women, strange, you know, and one from the government side. And it carried on. Certainly after 9/11, there was the interest changed. And you could almost say that the Western curator, visitor, really what they were looking for, without saying it, and actually some even confidentially probably did, that they were looking for a veiled woman artist who was painting nudes. I mean, that was really what they were after.
That's a specialty of Iranian
artists. Okay, yeah, exactly, right. And that was problematic, because the artists were then being offered these opportunities, but they were being pigeonholed. I mean, there's been so much written about this kind of ethnic marketing over the years, but at that particular time, it was really problematic, because the artists had to ask themselves, do I say no? I don't want to be framed in Islamic art of Egypt when my work is about something else completely different. Do I miss the opportunity of somebody seeing my work because I don't like that framing? I'm going to take that. I mean, of course, I was spending hours and hours with artists having these discussions, and it was their decision. And I would say 90% of them opted to go take their work abroad and have it framed. And to be fair, some of them, this was a major opportunity for them. And people did go into that exhibition, and they did see beyond the labels, and things did move forward. And that was really great. But then there was other times when the less sensitive of the sort of the Western world would actually say, well, we'll take this, and they would frame that person's work, despite the fact that the work was about something completely different. And that framing often was very detrimental to the artist. So there was this constant balance. And then, of course, not just in Egypt, but regionally as we developed networks, this discussion was happening in Beirut, it was happening in Palestine, it was happening, you know, literally in the Gulf as well. What does one do? And then you also realize that there was this, that artists themselves were feeding into this. And they were feeding into this whole notion of the Arab artist label. And it was working for them. So this was also other things that you had to balance.
Right. I guess because we don't have a huge amount of time, I wanted to fast forward to 2011 and the uprising of 2011, and which literally happened on your doorstep. So, you know, tear gas, curfews, protests were very much a part of your daily reality for years, and then through a counter-revolution and then its legacies. And I just wonder, I wasn't obviously working with you at that time, but from a distance, it looked like your priorities changed. And I wonder if we can talk a little bit about that. I think I remember meeting someone who had visited Cairo and visited the gallery and said, you know, I was expecting a sort of Egyptian Kunst Hall or, you know, or a white cube space where I can see the best of the best. And they were quite disappointed in the fact that it had become something closer to, I don't want to say a community center, but it was, again, serving multiple constituencies, not just contemporary artists. And I just want to revisit that and maybe hear from you, in your words, what your priorities were at that time and how you were shifting and how you were reacting to that shifting landscape post-2011. What changed?
Yeah, I mean, that's good, but I think, and I spoke about this before, in the past, and Annie was sitting right in front of me, and she was, you know, holding the gallery together far more than I was at that time, in many respects, so I would almost want her to answer this, but I think that the violence was real, and it was all around us, and you can't get away from that, and that violence will stay with you, because it was just awful. Those 18 days were difficult. I was staying in the gallery at the time for a lot of them, and around the corner, and we had resident artists that were locked into the hotels, you know, also around the corner. But we were still out every day, and the artists were out every day, but the artists weren't working as artists. The artists were actually out in the square as demonstrators, and I'm talking about everybody. Every single person that I knew that was either an audience member or as a practitioner, they were in the square and they were back in the lane constantly for discussions and talks and using the gallery as a production space for printing out demands in the 18 days. And, you know, we would, not me, I had nothing to do with that, but they would be printing out these saying, these are the 12 demands today. And then by the time they were printed out and being handed out, you know, they'd already given in. So they're like, you know, now there's only 10 demands, but we're still demanding those other two. And that was a constant trying to keep up with the government caving in and the artists pushing. And I think literally after the 18 days, one could almost say that everybody wanted the space because of its locale. Everybody wanted the space to carry out their own mission. And whether it was to work with the referendum, whether it was actually... And I think, you know, artists wanted to perform because there was no police in the streets. So we could do anything. I mean, it was a remarkable 6 months after the 18 days. And I constantly kept looking, and I'm sure Annie did as well, just over our shoulder, thinking, is this real? I mean, somebody's bound to object to it.
It was a brief utopia.
It was an incredible period. But, of course, at the same time, you did have the Ikhwan and the Brotherhood moving in, and that all of a sudden, you know, beards started appearing everywhere, and people were the Salafis started appearing everywhere. And they started to sort of watch over your shoulder a little bit, but they weren't in power. So they could watch over your shoulder, and they could say whatever they want, but they didn't have the power to stop you. I mean, really, it was... and everybody was... Nobody cared about the foreign visitors. This is an absolute certainty. Everybody that was performing, everybody that was producing work, during that period, they were doing it for Egyptians. They were doing it for the people in the street. They were doing it for people who were still in the square, in Abdelmadjid and Riyadh, around the corner. I mean, visitors coming in and out, they would just come in and out and nobody cared. And, you know, being a foreigner myself, it was very similar. You know, everyone just sort of brushed past me and kept going on.
And would you say even some of the art that you began to show was different? More, I mean, I saw more performance, things that were a little bit more experimental, ephemeral.
Yes, I think so. But as I say, because it was directed specifically, like Lessons in Revolting by Leila Sulman, that performance that went on and on, and there was a lot of testimonial work that was being done, you know, and people were still being arrested, and they were, you know, being held in the museum. Artists were being arrested and coming back. So there was a lot of testimonial work in all of the spaces. And then there were artists, you know, that were actually arguing against that and saying we really have to go back and just start practicing again. And we're living in a different time, and we need to be talking about this time in using our processes. So there was a lot of discussion going on at that time because of that. But it changed. There's no way that one can say, you know, what happened in 2013, we all went back to what it was. That absolutely is not true.
The coup d'etat that...
Yes. You saying that.
Yes, I said that. You didn't say that.
No, I did not say that. But, I mean, you cannot go back. And the reason you can't go back is while we had an exodus of artists after 2013, we had an exodus of intellectuals, writers at every level. And obviously people had died. People were being imprisoned. I mean, this vacuum that certainly existed was a challenge. What does one do? But then suddenly you remember that Egypt, Cairo, is 20 million people. You know, and a handful of people, activists, had left, had disappeared. But you still had this incredible number of people in the streets. And if you look at the Hal Badil Festival video, it shows you, that was 2013, you still could get 1,000 people in the streets. The youth literally had a different attitude. And they do today. And I describe that attitude because I witness it all. I mean, literally, I remember having a conversation with you, I think it was you, last September, and I saying how shocked I was by the behavior of these, when the schools opened, the young people in my street, I just thought, and everybody in our street, we were really shocked by their, you know, smoking, the girls were smoking, hanging around the guys' necks, and I mean, hello? This is just not acceptable. I mean, in our culture, I mean, this kind of freedom and the clothes they were wearing was like, wait a minute. But I assumed this is downtown, this is townhouse, this is the lane, this can't be happening everywhere else. And then school had been opened a week, and then a week later the Minister of Education turned around and banned all of this kind of behavior throughout the country. So this attitude of, you know, Tawfiq authority, you know, it's really... We just don't respect authority. Right. We don't have respect for our parents in that respect. I mean, it's don't tell us what to do. And that, it's an apolitical approach, but it's also visible. And that visibility has also meant that they're a new audience, and artists have emerged that are producing work that reminds me very much in terms of materials, the materialism of the early 1999, 2000. But rather than looking at the city, they're actually looking at the personal. Mm-hmm. And that personal extends outside of Egypt. It extends into memory, repair, protocols. It's critical in a way, and it's so nuanced that when you do have visitors, and we do still, of course, have our authority visitors, when they come in, they don't know, is this good? Is this criticizing us? Is this complimenting us? Is this just a load of rubbish? You know, And the guys who work in the lane, the guys who work for us, they know how to deal with them. And so it's fine.
In spite of the depressing political news, it's one of the byproducts has been a new way of art making, a new sort of sensibility, a new relationship to the political and personal.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, I will just say one thing and then you can tell me to go. When our building collapsed, and I'm sure most people realize, you know, this was in 2016, and a lot was written about it, and a lot was written about the symbolism of the partial collapse.
We back up, it was December of 2015 that the gallery was raided by
the authorities,
and then there were a number of outstanding cases against the gallery.
Yes.
I don't know how many ministries.
There was nine cases.
Yeah. So that's December, and then April...
Yes. December, they raided and shut us down completely. Then they allowed us to open, but not to program. And just to go back into the spaces and try and... After the raid, so many things were gone. They took computers and archival work. And then literally, in April, a month later, a section of the building collapsed. And that really was that was it for everybody. It was just like... but there was a standoff between the authorities, because they came to demolish the building the next day. Unheard of in Egypt. It normally takes months to demolish a building. I mean, you know, whoa, but 24 hours later, all of a sudden all these guys with AK-47s and hammers, I mean, it does not happen. And, do you know, I'm the kind of person that would have said, okay, well, if you've got the papers, you got the hammer and the gun, off you go. But the street, no. The street actually set up barriers. They absolutely refused. They would not allow people into the space. It was a standoff for a week that attracted so much attention. But the symbolism of the fall really was so traumatic on so many people. And literally, we had to do... We heard rumors that the army was coming in, and nobody wants to mess with the army. Just a word of advice there. And so everybody said, we have to clear, even the street, we've just got to clear that building out completely. So we did a call on Facebook, and it was literally a human chain that worked all night long, emptying the building and everything out from the people who lived there, the bra guy, and all his bras, everything came out. And people's furniture, every artwork, everything that we could, we salvaged. And then the demolishers went in. And they went in and they specifically made sure that you could never use that building again. They went into the center of the floors, damaged these beautiful 19th century floors. So it made holes in the floors, ripped everything out, ripped the balconies off. But literally they had the building for 24 hours. And then we managed to have our lawyers with the connections, a piece of paper saying, you touch one more piece of stone of that building and you'll all be charged. And everybody left. Because it was a legal paper that the building itself was sound. And the damage that was being done was far greater than the damage that collapsed.
It was sound, though it collapsed.
No.
I've always been worried about that.
Yeah, I know you. Yeah, you know, we have to talk about this. and the thing is that we have, over the last 8 or 9 months, this building was so, as a symbol, so powerful, and it just became a shell. And we kept programming, and we were working in the factories and the Ruwaba, the theater spaces.
You moved to the space.
Yeah, I mean,
the street.
We just carried on. And this building loomed over us, but the neighbors, and we could not, no matter how many people in this room wanted to give us money at that time, and reached out. I'm trying to remember, did anybody? We couldn't have accepted it. And in fact, the government obviously was not going to give us money. But we had this building, and the street wanted the building back. The community, those people that we talked about at the very beginning. And we're talking about a working community. They set up a neighborhood group. We were part of it, obviously. And as a neighborhood group, every month, everybody put in money. And literally, we hired surveyors, architects, we paid what we had to pay to who we needed to pay. And in that 8 months, we rebuilt the collapsed section of the building. We restored all of the floors. The workshops downstairs were expanded. The community paid for it. And that in itself is a story that really should resonate everywhere, because it's an art space. It's a hub, but it's a living space. And when that balcony went up, we had a new balcony. It looks exactly like the old one. You love it. And when it went up there, that was really a moment for the street, because all of a sudden you could stand on the balcony and have that conversation again. The building came back alive. And now it's open. It's working. We've had exhibitions. We've had programs. It's we're now all of our buildings are working.
Yeah.
And it's a strange feeling that we are back to where we were. And it is wonderful also because artists that disappeared, that for rightful reasons, for depression, left the country, just went into the suburbs, they're coming back, and they're coming back with proposals. They're excited. They enter into the building and they just feel like, if the building can come back, you get that from them. I have work. I want to show you work. And that's where we are right now. And we are looking at proposals and proposals and proposals. And in a year's time, there's going to be, a whole new set of artists added to this.
No, you answered my next question, which was this fragility or this precarious nature of the gallery always being at risk of being shut down or falling apart, or it actually serves you at some level. I mean, the way that you manage to improvise, work with the community, and find a creative solution and build new constituencies en route, I think is extraordinary. More question is, I mentioned very briefly in the introduction that a lot of other organizations have come to be via Townhouse. So whether it's people who've worked with you, or interestingly, people who worked in opposition to you, criticized Townhouse, but who somehow were born in response to the work that you were doing. And I wonder if you can tell me a little bit more about that sort of that incubation function that you've played over the
years. Yeah, absolutely. And I will do it shortly and quickly, because everyone in the room knows that the Ministry of Culture in Egypt is monolithic, because we're not just talking about visual arts, the opera house and so forth. You're talking about the pyramids, for God's sake. I mean, the budget of the Ministry of Culture is next to the military budget. Well, it was. I don't know if that's true today, because we're getting a lot of French planes and submarines and things. But it's a huge, huge, massive, the ministry. And Townhouse is, look at the maquette, this little building with all of these things, no matter everything that we've talked about. You cannot pretend that you're important. You can never think that, no matter, you realize that you need an infrastructure. You need support. And so, literally, and there were so many people that were coming to me with ideas and saying, I want to set up a space, I want to do an initiative, but I don't want to risk it, I don't have the money, and for a lot of them, that's where we actually said, okay, we'll take a space. CIC, for example, we said, all right, take that. We're not using that annex. Take it for a year. Build yourself up. Get yourself a board. And then move on. And they did. And they took over. It's now the contemporary photographic and moving image space in the city. And it's a reference point. And then you have Madrar. Madrar was a bunch of young Egyptians in their early 20s who came and said to me, we never attend anything at Townhouse. And I said, why, guys? And they're like, we don't understand a word. And I said, it's all in Arabic. You don't speak English. And they said, yeah, but we don't understand this curatorial talk. And, we don't understand what it is you're talking about. So we want to set up a space of our own where we can peer learn, and we need help. So that's where we said, okay. So I actually met with them every week for 9 months. Wow, that's a commitment. Really? And they're thriving now. And I was able to give them a grant. And, when I say they're thriving, they're surviving. Other spaces actually came to me, and they opened up, and they were brilliant spaces. And they actually just said, you know, I'm an artist. I brought you my work several times, and I didn't recognize them. I didn't recognize the work. And they said, you rejected it. And I said, I'm sorry. I'm going to continue rejecting it. And they said, well, then we decided we're going to open up our own space. And in opposition to us. And it turned out to be one of the most important spaces outside of the downtown area, really working and setting up residencies and so forth. It closed this year, unfortunately. A number of spaces,
which
initiatives. Arteloa, which is farther out. So we have had, over the last 5 or 6 years, particularly spaces, a lot of spaces opened up, and almost most of them have closed down because of the restrictions that we're facing. But, you know, I really am an optimist, and I really do honestly believe that because that building is back up, because our program is so strong, the more people will be coming and challenging us with new spaces and new ideas, and we're there as not just a space and a gallery in a sense, but really as advisors, as mentors, in every single possible way we can. That's part of the role.
Right. Do we have time for one more question, or is this a good one?
But keep it short.
I will.
My answer, not
you know, in Bidoun, we published a text by Haysam El-Wardani, who's a great Egyptian writer based in Berlin, about sleep and about the revolutionary possibilities inherent in sleep. It's a beautiful lyrical text. And then Anya, who's going to speak on the next panel, has written quite a bit about retreat and slowness in a moment of political upheaval, which I find very compelling and interesting. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts about that vis-a-vis how you, strategies of survival. There's a great expectation that you're obviously fighting the good fight, you're at the barricades, etc., but it's not always like that. And I just wonder, does that speak to you at all, that notion of sleep or retreat? Or
yes, absolutely. I mean, I might not use those words. I'm not even sure I understand them. You know, but I will say that, you know, when we opened up the gallery in 1998, I had people that were working in the arts who had attempted to open up independent spaces. And they told me straight out that what you must aim for is survival. Just survive, and you will have succeeded. And that was just a joke to me. What was the point of creating a space for its own sake? It was ridiculous. In 2016, and it wasn't just me, every institution felt survival for survival's sake was a joke. In 2016, when the building collapsed and everybody came together, certainly every director of every space that I know, and we would be all sitting around, and we all agreed, at this moment in time, survive. Just for this moment, survival is what we need to do. And everybody agreed on that. And it was like we were holding on with a thread because we didn't know what was going to happen next. That was in 2016. This is 2018. If anybody actually said to me or anyone else today, survive, that's a joke. That is an absolute joke. We survived. Now you move on. So that notion of that slowness, it was so important for us. So, so important for us. But there is a time when you actually need to move out of that, and you really need to be active, proactive, and aggressive. Because I think we're actually doing a program right now, it's very aggressive, and I'm waiting for a slap in the face from
Can
certain
you tell
people.
Us very briefly what it is.
Go to the website. And I mean, I think that, you know, you're going to have to constantly do that.
I'm just lobbing one last question. Okay. Is what is the best possible future for Town House, do you think? Is that too big?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So maybe we can go back to the
next.
What you said, very aggressive in what way?
You know, okay, I guess aggressive meaning putting forward programs that you know you're not supposed to do. And you know it could get you into a lot of trouble. So you work in all the different ways that you can, so when they do come at you, you can go, "You're kidding. Really?" And yeah, it's an aggressive program. And I'm concerned.
Which in a way, is your protection?
Certainly the response that we've had, possibly, it's our protection, or else it's going to just draw too much attention to us. That's the other thing. You know, it's like, I will actually just say one of the important things about being here at the Mosaic Church, and thanking Rachel for this incredible opportunity, you know, like when we had this conversation and you offered it, I mean, people thought we were asleep. People thought Townhouse had died. People thought, oh, the good old Townhouse. And so, you know, particularly not in Cairo, but outside of Egypt. So when Rachel said, you know, "You want my building? And, you know, and I'll help you pay for it." That was a real opportunity to be able to show people here in London and anywhere else that we are alive and kicking and we're back. And, I mean, this is really an important statement for us. Our just being here with this selection, this fraction of our history, not a retrospective, a fraction.
What an uplifting moment to end. So, yeah, thank you, William.